Welcome to Some Very Famous People You've Never Really Heard Of, bite-sized biographies of the famous, the infamous, and the quirky in less than an hour. My name is Philip D. Gibbons, and there is more information about me, this podcast, and a bibliography at someveryfamouspeople.com. There are also photographs of many of the individuals and items mentioned in this podcast. At the conclusion of part two of this presentation, there will be additional suggestions concerning further information about today's subject, Hiram Bingham, the real Indiana Jones, and the lost city of Machu Picchu. Now let's continue with our story about Hiram Bingham. Bingham hoped to return to Peru in June of 1911. 1910 had been a busy year. Bingham, his wife, and their now six sons moving into a 30-room house in New Haven, among the city's largest, again courtesy of his in-laws. Besides these real-life distractions, Bingham was intent on funding his next trip to South America on his own, with official academic sanction and not Tiffany money. That proved to take longer, but eventually a seven-man team was assembled, funded, and officially named the Yale Peruvian Expedition. Each participant had to come up with $1,800, either by donation or on their own. Bingham pre-sold articles to Harper's Magazine for $1,000, and so intent on refusing any money from his wife or in-laws, he sold the last tract of Honolulu land that he had inherited from his grandfather for $800. However, he did ask for an additional $1,800 for the expedition's doctor, rationalizing it by convincing his wife that he stood a much better chance of not having a medical incident if professional help was available 24/7. Interest in the expedition was such that Bingham was interviewed by high-profile media outlets like the Christian Science Monitor and the New York Sun. He downplayed any focus on finding gold. Instead, his stated interest was in finding ruins that would shed more light on the Incan civilization. He denied that any artifacts or valuables would be presented to Yale. Instead, he claimed that they would be turned over to the Peruvian government, a judicious answer, as that was Peruvian law. Bingham arrived in Peru on June 23, 1911, coming ashore at the capital of Lima. He met with several Peruvian officials and scholars about getting official permission to physically conduct any form of scientific exploration of any Incan ruins and to get advice on where exactly the lost cities of the Incas might be. Through the intervention of an official of the W.R. Grace Company, an American entity that had a virtual monopoly on all of Peru's railroads and commerce, after assuming Peruvian government debt in the late 19th century, Bingham got a face-to-face meeting with the president of Peru, Augusto Leguia. As the country was already in a state of unrest over nationalist objections concerning foreign exploitation of Peruvian natural resources and unfair labor practices, the president figured that any indication of mutual international cooperation concerning such an academic matter could only be a good thing. He gave Bingham his blessing, even warning him of potential hostility from locals already incensed by British and U.S. behavior. Next, Bingham conferred with several historians and came to the conclusion that the lost city he was seeking might actually be two cities, Vilcabamba and another site known in text written by Spaniards hundreds of years ago as Vitcos. By early July, Bingham was in Cusco, his team assembled and ready to head into the jungle. His expedition of seven men were split into three groups with separate assignments. Group 1 was assigned to perform a topographic survey in the lower Urubamba Valley. Group 2 was to map the region along the Urubamba and Vilcabamba rivers, noting all settlements and small villages. Group 3, Bingham and naturalist Harry Foote, were to collect insects and plant life and seek out Incan ruins, Foote focused on the former and Bingham the latter. In further conversations with various Cusco officials, he heard again about another set of potential ruins along the Urubamba River, high on a hill. One local policeman was even more specific, telling Bingham to follow the Urubamba until the settlement of Torontoy. There he should inquire about the location of ruins the officer called Huaynapichu, meaning literally New Peak. Bingham duly noted this information, intent on verifying such claims along the way. By July 19th, with mules and even an armed military escort named Sergeant Carrasco, Bingham began to follow the route of Manco Inca as he fled Cusco, intent on beginning a real resistance to the Spanish occupation. Bingham encountered his first ruins at the former Incan fortress of Ollantaytambo. Dazzled by mountain scenery he described as more impressive than the Rockies or even the Alps. Faced several times with options as to which path he would follow, Bingham stayed as close to the Urubamba as he could. The prospect of perhaps finding the aforementioned Huaynapichu uppermost in his mind. Unfortunately, his euphoria over once again traveling in the footsteps of the Incans was dampened by the drowning death of one of the young indigenous porters accompanying the expedition, who was swept away while attempting to cross the swift Urubamba. Aside from a brief journal entry, Bingham minimized this incident, the only death ever to occur on his various expeditions. That he did not pause his expedition did not endear him to the local population, only confirming him to them as another foreigner focused only on his own interests. Bingham methodically pushed on, heading for Torontoy and leaving the incident behind. In the vicinity of the Torontoy ruins, Bingham, Foote, and their small entourage found a clearing at the base of what looked to be a tall jungle-covered mountain. A perfect campsite, they drew the attention of a local merchant who was somewhat dismayed that the party was not staying at his nearby dwelling. Later, Bingham would relate, "Our actions, however, aroused the suspicions of the owner of the hut, Melchor Arteaga, who leases the lands of Mandor Pampa. He was anxious to know why we did not stay at his hut like respectable travelers. Our gendarme, Sergeant Carrasco, reassured him. They had quite a long conversation. When Arteaga learned that we were interested in the architectural remains of the Incas, he said there were some very good ruins in this vicinity. In fact, some excellent ones on top of the opposite mountain called Huaynapichu, and also on a ridge called Machu Picchu." The next morning, when Arteaga, hungover, began to equivocate on his offer to guide Bingham to the ruins, Bingham offered a sole, a Peruvian silver dollar, about four times the going day rate in 1911. Foote, the naturalist, and the expedition doctor, Irving, hard passed on the hike. Bingham and Carrasco alone tried to keep up with Arteaga, following on hands and knees across the Urubamba via a crude log bridge before ascending for 90 minutes, practically straight up a steep vegetation-choked trail. Finally, they reached a plateau and a clearing. Bingham was surprised to see a hut and cleared cultivated farmland, the home of one of three farmers who lived in the vicinity. This individual gazed warily out of his hut, understanding that nobody came to this part of the world accidentally and rarely with any good intentions. It took a conversation with Arteaga to calm down the local resident, reassuring him that the strange-looking tall Bingham and his military companion were merely interested in the nearby ruins. The local farmer, Melquiades Richarte, then produced some cold water to drink and a lunch of cooked sweet potatoes, grown locally, no doubt. After this brief respite, Arteaga decided to relax and chat with Richarte. The farmer's young son would serve as Bingham's guide to the ruins that still remained concealed from the explorer's plateau vantage point. He had diminished expectations, disappointed on numerous occasions after receiving descriptions of wonderful unexplored ancient structures that resulted in letdowns. But, subsequently, in his own words, Bingham described a remarkable moment of discovery. "We scrambled along the dense undergrowth, climbing over terrace walls and in bamboo thickets where our guide found it easier going than I did. Then the little boy urged us to climb up a steep hill over what seemed to be a flight of stone steps. Surprise followed surprise in bewildering succession. We came to a great stairway of large granite blocks. Then we walked along a path to a clearing where the Indians had planted a small vegetable garden. Suddenly we found ourselves standing in front of the ruins of two of the finest and most interesting buildings in ancient America. Made of beautiful white granite, the walls contained blocks of cyclopean size, higher than a man. The sight held me spellbound. I could scarcely believe my senses as I examined the larger blocks in the lower course and estimated that they must weigh from 10 to 15 tons each. Would anyone believe what I had found? Fortunately, in this land where accuracy of reporting what one has seen is not a prevailing characteristic of travelers, I had a good camera and the sun was shining. There was only one downside to Bingham's remarkable day. On the side of one of the ruins' walls, he noticed in practically a graffiti-like scrawl in charcoal the words Lizarraga, 1902. As Bingham would come to understand in the next few months, although visitors from the outside world to this site were very rare, unfortunately for him, they were not unprecedented. From his first day at Machu Picchu, Bingham's challenge was to present to the world the idea that, much like Columbus discovering America, he had discovered Machu Picchu. Surprisingly, although he knew that he had observed something of great interest, Bingham also knew that this Machu Picchu, as Arteaga referred to it, based on its location and proximity to Cusco, was not the last redoubt of the Incas. So focused on finding this location, or locations, Bingham left Arteaga's campsite the next day. He eventually did successfully locate both Vitcos and Vilcabamba, but he left Peru in December of 1911, not exactly sure how these three ancient ruins fit together. By the time he returned home, met by journalists anxious to write about another explorer in a world fascinated with the exploits of Scott and Amundsen, Percy Fawcett, Richard Burton, and various other intrepid explorers, Bingham was now talking up Machu Picchu as not only his most impressive discovery, but also the point of origin of the Inca Empire, dating back to the era of Manco Capac. He also emphasized that he had not found huge caches of silver and gold, but that was not the point. The point was the study and excavation of the ruins themselves, a point he made to both Yale University and the National Geographic Society as a pitch for additional funding. Bingham did gloss over the fact that the Peruvian government had finally implemented strict rules regarding any future excavation of ancient sites and specifically forbade the export of antiquities of any kind. In ongoing discussions with both Yale and the National Geographic Society, Bingham implied that he would find a workaround. He already had quietly returned with a modest amount of skeletal remains and artifacts, and with fellow alumni like President William Howard Taft, he figured he could make a deal with the government, even if it was unique to Yale, and he did, this time getting the Leguia government to sign off on Yale getting a 10 to 20 year concession to excavate, essentially an unofficial monopoly. Such an agreement would have to be ratified by the Peruvian Congress, but at the time, that was considered a formality. In return, any antiquities that were recovered were to be split 50-50. Bingham quickly raised $25,012 from Yale and the NGS. By July 1912, Bingham and a new team of excavators and academics were on site back at Machu Picchu. They were accompanied by almost a dozen indigenous locals who were asked firmly by the local government to help the expedition, these individuals receiving rather modest salaries. Bingham's initial excavation efforts found little other than emptied out holes, the easily accessible areas of the site obviously looted of anything of value. He then enlisted three local farmers, the aforementioned Richarte, Anacleto Alvarez, and a man named Fuentes, into locating any burial caves they could find in the area, promising to pay them a finder's fee. Bingham also had to make a deal with Mariano Ferro, the actual landowner of the site, promising one-third of Yale's share for the right to excavate, the expectation that vast stores of gold and silver could emerge at any time. Ferro also sent an individual named Yara to look over Bingham's shoulder, this definitely a trust but verify transaction. It wasn't long before the farmers led Bingham to ancient human remains and other contents of several graves. However, none of the locals and hired hands were particularly wild about this process of glorified grave robbing. Such an intrusion, especially by wealthy foreigners, a serious violation of indigenous customs and superstitions. Bingham himself delegated much of this work to his team, heading off on horseback to the vicinity of Vilcabamba, most likely bored with the actual archaeological process and scientific analysis involved in excavating Machu Picchu. A national change of attitude also was manifested in Peru's 1912 presidential election, conducted during Bingham's 1912 expedition, in which the Leguía government was supplanted by a more populist-minded individual with the unlikely name of Guillermo E. Billinghurst. The excavation and removal of Peruvian antiquities by foreign nationals was part of a greater focus of the government of Peru on the ongoing exploitation of the country's natural resources and infrastructure and the public's hostility to such an environment. Suddenly, Yale's concession and even any ability to remove artifacts for any reason was jeopardized by hostility expressed by both members of the new administration and the Peruvian press. However, because of Bingham's prominence and the involvement of the State Department, the Peruvian Ministry of Education reached a compromise, allowing Bingham and Yale's expedition a one-time exception to export artifacts excavated in Peru, as long as they were first inventoried by a designated Peruvian official. The agreement also contained a clause that underlined that at any time in the future, Peru could ask for any or all of its items back. Eventually, 93 small crates of various bones, pottery, and other bronze and metal objects were shipped out of the country, the Peruvian official in charge of an inventory merely weighing and noting the general contents, perceived to be mostly bones and broken pottery and of only archaeological and academic value. But there are indications that a great deal of valuable artifacts, mostly composed of silver and bronze, were hidden and ultimately secretly removed. The expedition understanding that if the Peruvian government did not know specifically what was removed, it could never ask for the items to be returned. Upon his late 1912 return to the U.S., Bingham began to prepare his article promised to the National Geographic. Editor Gilbert Grosvenor was thrilled by the first draft, enough to postpone the article's release, increase the number of photographs to devote an entire issue of the magazine to Bingham's Machu Picchu essay, and expand the print run to 210,000 copies, a 33% bump. The focus was on the magnificent ruin and Bingham's groundbreaking contribution concerning perhaps the most important of the continent's ancient civilizations. The issues concerning Peru's canceling of Yale's concession were not discussed. The U.S. media and public response was wildly enthusiastic, and Bingham became a recognizable public figure, the dashing explorer who discovered the lost city of Machu Picchu. A book contract soon followed, and Bingham's lectures, more anecdotal than scholarly, were packed with students drawn by his newfound celebrity. Bingham had been so put off by the Peruvian government's nationalistic attitudes that he vowed never to return. But a military coup had overthrown Billinghurst's government, and the new conservative regime was much more receptive to Bingham's proposal for another Yale-led expedition. Bingham maintained that he and his team would focus more on formally concentrating on charging geographical maps of various ruins and establishing an archaeological center where Americans and Peruvians could collaborate on anthropological studies of whatever artifacts were unearthed, with all such antiquities remaining in Peru. But Bingham's public persona and official stance while dealing with the Peruvian government was disingenuous. In April of 1914, Bingham received an offer from Tomas Alvistor to sell Bingham his collection of intact Peruvian artifacts. Alvistor was the son-in-law of Carmen Vargas, the extremely wealthy owner of a hacienda in the Machu Picchu area. By then, Bingham knew that Machu Picchu especially had been picked clean and looted of anything but some broken pottery or bone fragments. The only way that he would get the kind of antiquities that would establish a respected collection at Yale was to buy them, and so he did, first from Alvistor. The deal they struck was for 366 pieces at a cost equal to about $250,000, $2024. Alvistor and his family were afraid that the Peruvian government might at any time also decide that any artifacts in private hands were also to be forfeited to the state, their motivation to cash in. Alvistor made it clear that bribes would have to be paid, but for Bingham, this was all a hands-off affair until mid-September 1914, when seven cases of antiquities were delivered to New Haven, safe and sound. While Bingham spent 1914 in Connecticut, his Yale-sponsored expedition continued its alleged geographical survey of remote territory, all the while on the lookout for anything of value. Although not as vast as the Alvistor haul, the expedition's doctor was able to smuggle out in his own luggage a modest amount of impressive artifacts that also wound up on Bingham's desk and eventually in Yale's museum collection. By April of 1915, Bingham was personally back in Peru to observe the Yale Archaeological Learning Center in Ollantaytambo and ultimately to trek to Machu Picchu over what today is known to hikers worldwide as the Inca Trail, including the infamous Warmiwanuska, or in English, Dead Woman's Pass, 14,000 feet above sea level. He continued on to Vitcos, he and his entourage celebrating when they got there, an acknowledgement of all he and his men had accomplished in the ruins of Peru. The group's serenity was shattered upon its return to Yale's archaeological outpost at Ollantaytambo. The head of Peru's Historical Institute, an institution devoted to safeguarding Inca artifacts, named Luis Valcarcel, had heard rumors of illegal gold smuggling, excessive and destructive excavations that left ruins damaged and unrestored, and even mistreatment of Peruvians, both at Yale's Archaeological Study Center and the workers who provided manual labor during the expedition. Subsequent to an investigation of both the propriety of Bingham's latest excavation and some of the sites that were excavated, Valcarcel demanded an official judicial inquiry into just exactly what Bingham had in his possession and what he intended to export. Cusco's public prosecutor's office, known as the Fiscal, agreed to hold a hearing on July 1, 1915. This hearing would include the examination of four boxes of artifacts seized during the investigation that Bingham's expedition had left behind in the care of a local. On July 1st in downtown Cusco, an inquiry was convened in which Valcarcel alleged that Bingham and his expedition deliberately violated Peruvian law in terms of both how the excavation was conducted and the intent to illegally remove artifacts. Bingham replied that he had not intended to remove any artifacts and that he meant to identify and study them in good faith. When the boxes were opened, they did contain broken pottery and an assortment of bones. While Valcarcel emotionally asserted that this was proof of Bingham and Yale's dishonesty, the tribunal was unimpressed. They expected cases filled with valuable silver and gold antiquities. These contents had very little monetary value. They were also diligently labeled and inventoried so that there would be no doubt as to what was excavated should anyone in the Peruvian government wish to document this. The prosecutor wasn't as outraged as Valcarcel would have liked, but he did acknowledge that Yale had excavated inappropriately. Just how inappropriately would be determined by a commission he would appoint. With the inquiry wrapped up for the day, Bingham and Yale remained in a legal limbo. The process further stalled when the prosecutor appointed Valcarcel as the head of this commission, but refused to pay him, so the head of the institute refused to do the work. Already enraged by the confiscation of the small number of boxes, Bingham decided, understanding that he would never be able to excavate and operate as he had previously, that he had had enough of Peru. After some delicate negotiations, he was permitted to leave despite the open-ended investigation, most likely through the intercession of well-connected foreign businessmen. During all of his expeditions to Peru, Bingham was routinely contacted by collectors wishing to openly and illegally sell him artifacts. He usually ignored such offers, but on his way out of the country for what he thought would be the last time, Bingham decided to pursue such a purchase, by now as much out of spite as any academic interest. He made it clear to the seller that it was up to the dealer to get it through customs, which he was told was not a problem, as the dealer had a relative who worked for that agency. supplying the pseudonym J.P. Simmons, Bingham would eventually receive the shipment after his arrival back in New Haven in October of 1915. The artifacts immediately donated to the Peabody Museum, all without any awareness of the Peruvian government. With his expedition and Peruvian Institute shut down and his return to campus, rumors of failure and even smuggling of extremely valuable gold and silver out of South America, Bingham felt denigrated. He initially sought help in the media, especially with Gilbert Grosvenor, but was advised to lay low. Any American PR campaign wasn't really necessary. Only a few scholars were even aware of Peru's attitude, and expanding the controversy would only tarnish public appreciation of his Machu Picchu discovery and subsequent journalism. Bingham turned in his final article to National Geographic, who decided shortly thereafter that they would not fund any additional trips to Peru. With the ongoing European conflict, expeditions to lost kingdoms on the edge of civilization suddenly seemed frivolous and self-indulgent. This cultural shift was not lost on Bingham. He immersed himself in both politics and an area that would be strategically important if the U.S. became involved in the war in Europe, aviation. Bingham was one of several prominent Republicans who, in May of 1916, personally attempted unsuccessfully to persuade Teddy Roosevelt to run for president. Roosevelt refused, but he encouraged Bingham to pursue his own political and military career. Bingham subsequently enrolled in a flight school run by aviation expert Glenn Curtis, a pursuit in line with his sense of adventure. A licensed pilot, in May of 1917, he was retained by the Army to form flight schools across the country, and he also spent time in France running the Allies' largest aviation training facility. When World War I concluded, Bingham then settled on a pursuit that was perfectly in line with his egocentric personality, politics. Initially encouraged and mentored by Teddy Roosevelt, Bingham, based on his high public profile and social standing, was first elected to public office in Connecticut in 1922 as lieutenant governor. Elected governor in 1924, Bingham took advantage of a special election when one of Connecticut's senators committed suicide in October, and Bingham handily won election in December of 1924 to the U.S. Senate. Sworn in as governor on January 7th, Bingham resigned and was then sworn in as U.S. Senator the next day. He's probably the only U.S. politician in American history to hold the office of lieutenant governor, governor, and U.S. Senator in a 24-hour period. Having had no official teaching responsibility at Yale for several years, he had already officially resigned from the university. Typically, Bingham made a deliberate splash in Washington. He hung his hat on expanding commercial aviation and exploited photo ops with Charles Lindbergh, Amelia Earhart, and President Coolidge. Appearing frequently on radio and speaking on the Senate floor, Bingham easily won re-election to a full six-year term in 1926, but his patrician attitude and public relations grandstanding grated on his colleagues. Bingham wound up in a scandal involving his hiring of a lobbyist from the Connecticut Manufacturers Association as a clerk in his office, and then allowing this individual access to closed-door meetings of Senate committees relevant to the association without making this individual's background clear. An initial inquiry might have blown over without any official sanction, but Bingham repeatedly and forcefully insisted that he had done nothing wrong, and characterized the ensuing investigation as politically motivated and vindictive. On November 4, 1929, in a lopsided vote, he was formally censured by the Senate for behavior, quote, contrary to the good morals and senatorial ethics, only the fourth such sanction up to that point in the body's history. To put this action in perspective, it would be over 20 years before the Senate acted in a similar fashion, this time citing Senator Joseph McCarthy. Although the Roosevelt presidential landslide wiped out a large number of Republicans, Bingham's censure was an embarrassing factor in his defeat for re-election in 1932. Bingham subsequently worked as an oil company executive and a lobbyist for aviation interests. He also wrote several books, the most notable entitled Lost City of the Incas, a bestseller published in 1948. As Machu Picchu was his most publicized excavation, Bingham always maintained that the site was actually the origin of the Inca Empire, as well as one of its last refuges. These theories were subsequently disproven that Machu Picchu was actually a royal estate built for Incan rulers to relax outside of the confines of central Cusco, the equivalent of an Incan Camp David. Bingham's personal life also underwent an upheaval in 1937 when his wife sued him for divorce, which was granted. During the proceedings, Alfreda Bingham, separated from her husband since 1932, alleged mental cruelty, a cold indifference to her, as well as an attitude of superiority. A month after the divorce was granted, Bingham married his longtime mistress. He lived out his final years in Washington, D.C., passing away on June 6, 1956, age 80. He was buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Although it is not known if he was aware of it during his lifetime, Bingham's journey to Machu Picchu was part of the plot of a low-budget 1954 Paramount film, Secret of the Incas, starring Charlton Heston, who in a leather jacket, scarf, and fedora bore a remarkable wardrobe resemblance to the real-life Bingham. This film was shot on location in Machu Picchu and Cusco and was the first Hollywood film ever made in the country of Peru. It would also literally be the wardrobe inspiration for Indiana Jones, according to the Raiders of the Lost Ark costume designer, who maintained that she and her team watched Secret of the Incas many times. Unfortunately, the screen homage was not the only acknowledgement of Bingham's legacy. As far back as 1917, the country of Peru began to request and ultimately demand the return of any artifacts in Yale's collection. Although the school did return some materials in 1922, these were described by Peruvian authorities as worthless. By then, Peruvian government officials were fully aware of Bingham's purchase of the Alvistor collection of artifacts, an awareness that only added to their insistence. Although Bingham always acknowledged that the collection was the property of the country of Peru, Yale continued to create excuses and delays, and ultimately the materials remained under the university's control. This dispute over the possession of valuable artwork or antiquities was not unique. Numerous countries have demanded that various museums worldwide return such items, including the Rosetta Stone and the Elgin Marbles, coincidentally both currently on display at the British Museum. Such demands continued throughout the 20th century, in Peru's case to no avail. Not only did the school not return the collection, it changed its public attitude, claiming at the turn of the 20th century that in fact Yale had a right to the antiquities based on legal precedents. In the U.S., this dispute received attention but was perceived as a battle involving an academic museum over some minor and obscure memorabilia. In Peru, the return of the artifacts achieved national prominence, with the government designated repatriation among its highest priorities. Throughout this process, the country threatened a lawsuit, but was reluctant to make good on this threat, as Yale continually offered differing responses, on occasion discussing either a partial or eventual return of all items. The school did allow an inspection of its collection in 2008, a concession that actually only added to Peru's determination, after it was determined that the university was in possession of over 46,000 items. While this number depended on definitions, it led to Peru's final exasperation and a civil lawsuit in 2009 filed in the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C. Several large demonstrations occurred in Peruvian cities, one even led by the country's president, who described Yale's behavior as a global crime. The school was also receiving criticism within the academic community. Such possession of another country's artistic heritage, a vestige of imperialism and colonization. The combination of Peruvian government determination and public opinion, not only across the academic U.S., but within the Yale campus itself, finally led to Yale's decision to return its entire collection. Finally, before the lawsuit substantively progressed, an agreement was reached in which Yale would return all materials in three installments, which were completed in November of 2012. Further revived examination of Bingham's colonialist behavior was a discussion that the university probably wished to avoid. Despite his abrupt departure and private vow never to come back, Hiram Bingham did actually return to Peru, underlining the love-hate relationship the country had and has with the explorer. In 1948, when a newly constructed highway that led from the train station closest to Machu Picchu to the ruins was dedicated as the Hiram Bingham Highway, the explorer personally took part in the dedication, joined by the mayor of Cusco and the U.S. ambassador. He spoke to a warm and appreciative crowd, calling his reception and dedication one of the most grateful moments of my life. Already a Peruvian awareness was building that in spite of some fundamentally insensitive behavior, Bingham helped to rediscover and popularize a lost monument and cultural treasure that today is a major attraction in a country that relies heavily on tourism. Every year, hundreds of thousands of tourists visit Machu Picchu, reinforcing its status as one of the seven modern wonders of the world. Thank you for listening to part two of this podcast about Hiram Bingham. Information for this podcast came from the books Cradle of Gold by Christopher Heaney and The Last Days of the Incas by Kim Macquarie. There are also additional photographs, bibliographical and musical information at someveryfamouspeople.com. If you have enjoyed this presentation, please like us at our Facebook page, Some Very Famous People, and follow us on Twitter at Philip D. Gibbons. Subscribe to my YouTube page at Noblesse Oblige, and please tell a friend about bite-sized biographies.